When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Meera V. Shah about her psychological suspense novel, Her. Meera is a writer, former city lawyer turned legal editor. She is the daughter of Indian African parents and lives in North London with her husband, three good dogs and one feral cat. In this episode, we discuss subverting stereotypes of British Asian women in fiction, how Meera added pace to her novel, and after her blog on the realities of being a debut gained traction online, Meera talks about how to manage expectations and to look after yourself. But first, here's Meera with an excerpt from Her.
The house draws me in like a magnetic force. Standing tall and proud, picture perfect, as if every single brick has been immaculately polished, emitting a warm orange glow that fizzes through my fingertips. I take my time walking towards it, easing myself into every step, listening to the sound of my 4-inch heels clicking on the pavement, my long cashmere coat brushing up against my bare legs. I tilt my head to the side, catching the scent of my freshly blow-dried hair bursting with honeydew and coconut, Asda's finest. He stands outside in a pressed navy suit, stretched tightly over his stocky frame, with slicked back hair a touch too wet. He's younger than he sounded on the phone. This must be his first big ticket sale. I bet he can almost taste that 2.5% commission. As I edge closer, he looks up, unable to stop himself from raising his eyebrows. I know what he must be thinking. This can't be her, can it? I expected someone different. Mrs. Rhodes, he asks quickly, before offering me a limp, clammy palm. Please, call me Serena. Paul? I don't recognise my own voice. It seems different somehow, as if squeezed out through pursed lips. My palms start to itch and my cheeks flush red hot. What if he can see right through me, that I don't belong here, looking to buy this house in this neighbourhood? I'm already 5 minutes late, and I notice the irritation crinkling his brow. I'm about to apologise but manage to swallow it down because that's not what Serena would do. Instead, I pull myself together, standing a little taller. Great, he nods, gesturing towards the building like a showman. So this is it, number 11. As you might expect with the curb appeal, space for three cars in the driveway and close to the sought-after Highgate School, we've had a lot of interest in this one. He turns towards the house and struts down the pristine mosaic path that I already know so well.
Hi, Meera. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, Her.
Oh, thanks, Chloe. I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm really pleased to have you. Can you start by telling us what Her is about?
Yeah, of course. So, I'll give you like the short version and then we can kind of delve into it in conversation. But essentially, whilst it's described as a thriller, I think I would probably describe it more as like a psychological drama. And it's set on a North London suburban street. And it's essentially about these two young women who are very, very different, but they strike up an unexpected friendship that leads to very devastating consequences. So that's my little short one pitch summary. I perfected over many months.
Yeah, that's what we've all got to practice, that pitch. I wondered where your inspiration began. I mean, part of me wonders whether you just saw an amazing house and started to think about who lived there. You tell me, where did it all begin?
Yeah, of course. So actually, like, readers who do sort of pick up the book probably won't be able to grasp this, because we'll sort of discuss there's so many different themes and stuff in the novel. But actually, for me, like, the seed was like the concept of like loneliness amongst young women, which I just felt like wasn't really talked about. Like, when you hear about loneliness, you hear about it in sort of like the elder community and that isolation. Whereas with Varney and Natalie, they're both kind of women in their 20s. And, you know, you don't really hear about sort of being isolated from society at that age. And, you know, there's much more emphasis on, like, you know, your life is beginning, and like, seize every opportunity that's available to you and enjoy, like, you know, meeting friends and doing new things and all that kind of stuff. But certainly my experience in my 20s wasn't like that. And so, yeah, I kind of, that was the seed. Like, I wanted to sort of reflect that, you know, that sort of other side of being, having this societal pressure on you, but not feeling like you were sort of part of society for various reasons. So yeah, that was it. Like, Ryan and Natalie, in very different kind of different ways, they both, the thing that unites them is the fact that they are both like lonely and sort of feel disconnected from society. So yeah, that was kind of the main seed. But yeah, definitely the whole, like, we were living in a flat at the time of sort of COVID when I wrote the novel, and flat in a very sort of wealthy area where you do get all these lovely houses. So certainly I would be lying if I didn't say that that wasn't part of it as well. Just sort of walking past was, as we all did, like, you know, on our daily walks, and kind of wondering who lived inside and what their story might be like. So yeah, I think, and yeah, sort of just to speak more on this in more depth, is that I'm kind of quite obsessed with this idea of like flawed perception. So like, we obviously live in the age of social media where there is this sort of compulsion to share the perfect version of your life to the world, and dress it up for the world. And that's just what we as a society, particularly in the younger generation, have got used to doing. And, you know, certainly through Natalie, I wanted to show that like, on the surface, she is this, like, you know, perfect creature with everything going for her. But as you, like, dig a little deeper, you find out that actually there's much more than meets the eye. And, you know, in fact, she's human like everyone else with the same problems. So, yeah, I think that was sort of part of the reason as well. So, yeah, a lot of mixed sort of inspirations. Yeah,
I'm interested to know then, kind of, you've talked about it as less of a thriller and more of a kind of psychological drama. What made it go down in that direction then, rather than, let's say, kind of just a, more of a kind of an exploration of loneliness? Why were you kind of tempted down that thrillery psychological suspense angle?
That's a really good question, Chloe, and I think it's probably says more about myself than anything else. Like, I'm definitely half glass empty with life than half glass full. So I'm quite like a cynic, or I should say realist by nature, not a cynic. So I tend to think that sort of you know, everything is relative, but everyone has skeletons in their closet. Everyone has things that they're fearful of, or, you know, a past that sort of won't let them go, kind of thing, whatever that is. Like, so I felt like with these characters, I wanted to sort of explore the darker side of life. And I think that sort of definitely came out in my writing. Like, I feel like I'm just drawn to that. And, you know, whilst like with the thriller genre, things are kind of maybe exaggerated a little bit in terms of like just to establish the twist and the element of surprise. I think, you know, it is relatable in the sense that there are sort of things that happen to both Ronnie and Natalie that a lot of people have experienced in their life as well. So, yeah, there is an element of sort of realism as well. So, yeah.
Touching back on that kind of realism element, one thing that you do is obviously, apart from kind of having a very engrossing page-turning plot, you do touch on kind of wider issues. You talked about their loneliness. You talk about kind of aspiration in women. Mm-hmm. You talk about race and kind of general, more larger issues about what it's like to be a woman in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. How important was it for you to explore those topics as well as kind of creating a exciting plot?
Oh yeah, like that was sort of first and foremost for me, I think. You know, it was partly sort of things like race, for example, and perhaps privilege and prejudice and things like that. I sort of hadn't really read about in this particular genre to that same degree. And you know, whilst there are books that explore this, like I think there's definitely room for more books that explore this. And I think, you know, certainly in Rani, like she's British Asian like myself, and I sort of struggle with the depiction of British Asians in literature, in modern literature, because a lot of the time there is sort of this element of sort of stereotyping in that, like, often I've seen the sort of doctor happens to be Asian, or the, you know, the perfect mother, or like the straight A student, and they have to have an Asian name. Whereas with Rani, I kind of wanted to just like throw away all of that and be like, this is someone that hasn't got her, am I allowed to swear? Hasn't got her shit together. You know, there's, you know, she's a real woman like you and me. And, you know, whilst she did do well in education, life didn't take her down that road, and she ended up being unemployed. And like, you know, she's not married. She's living with a partner. She had two children out of wedlock, which is perhaps not the traditional image of an Indian woman that many people might perceive or but seen in literature. So I kind of wanted to like create this like person that kind of did away with all stereotypes. And yeah, and so that was kind of the sort of race element to it. Mm. And also with prejudice, I thought was quite interesting, because even with Rani, particularly with Rani and Natalie, so you know, like for example, Natalie's husband is very prejudiced when he meets Rani. Like, he just sees her as this like scruffy you know, stay-at-home mom that hasn't got her shit together and like isn't going anywhere. But actually she's kind of the driving force behind the novel, which is quite interesting. But on the flip side, you see sort of Rani, who's maybe her sort of, she sees Natalie through her own lens, and she's prejudiced when she sees Natalie, because she sees this like well together perfect white woman and someone that she's sort of maybe idolized or wants to be like. And actually at the end of the book, I can't remember exactly the phrase, even though I did write it, but she says something like, you know, how wrong I was like to assume that you were this kind of person, when actually, you know, you had all this stuff going on that you get, yeah, that you were sort of dealing with. So yeah, the prejudice like work definitely works both ways, and I kind of wanted to explore that. So yeah.
Did you always have it in your mind as a dual narrative, or did you ever think you were just going to write it from Rani's perspective? I mean, I think there are obviously in your genre, there are so many dual narrative books, because you want to kind of hold things back from one character and yeah, secrets from another. Yeah. But did you ever consider any other alternative point of view?
No, you know what? I think even from the very beginning of writing it, I always kind of envisaged it as a dual narrative novel, because I was kind of interested in the interplay between the two characters. So they where they sort of start off in like very different positions in their lives. So, you know, if you were kind of almost plotting it on a graph, like Rani's in a very negative position and Natalie's in a very sort of positive position, but over the course of the novel it kind of flips, or like they sort of meet in this kind of, yeah, very mutual position, and then you see Rani's fire and you see Natalie's decline. So it's kind of like I liked exploring that these two kind of women, their situations kind of flip and due to certain certain events that occur throughout the novel. So I just couldn't. And I think the other thing is, what I could do is I could sort of explore the women through each other's lens and see how that changes. And I found that interesting, and I wouldn't be able to do that with if I just written it from, say, Rani's perspective. So, I think it definitely sort of adds a certain element to the book, seeing it from both sides. And I hope readers also go on that journey and see things from both sides as well through the characters. But what did change was actually I started off writing in third person. I don't know what it is, maybe I read more novels or have read more novels in third person, but it just felt weird to me writing in first person. But actually it was on this course that I did, the CBC course that a lot of us did, didn't we? So that someone suggested, or it was one of like the one of the pieces of homework we had to do, was to flip a chapter into different POV or different time period or whatever, or different, yeah. And I kind of changed to first person, and everyone was like, oh my god, the whole book's come alive. So yeah, that was a realization for me that like that it does make a big difference, like
I love that, and that just made such a huge difference. And sometimes as simple as changing something like that, although sometimes the work that goes into changing a tense or a perspective is harder than you think.
Yes, exactly.
But one thing I have to pick you up on is that I've read in so many places that you're not a planner, and I wonder this because you're writing a book that's got twists, you're writing a book that's got, you know, has to be really tightly plotted and paced. How do you do it if you don't plan it? What's your kind of working method?
Chloe, I have to confess something to you, that the original novel is very different to the final version that readers will read. And in all honesty, and I can, you know, freely admit this, that pace is a weakness of mine, which is strange when you think about that I'm a thriller writer. It should be the strength, but it's character is definitely my strength and pace is my weakness. So, you know, I had really intense structural edits, and a lot of it was like, this chapter is really beautifully written, but what does it do? Like, where does it take the novel? And I really struggled with pacing. And I know the likes of Lisa Jewell, how many novels in, she still doesn't plot. But I think at some point I'm going to have to admit that pantsing is just not the right the most efficient way for me to write a novel. And I'm going to have to flip to the plotting side of things, because I think you're right. When you're pantsing, it's almost perhaps because you don't have this like bigger picture of your novel, that when you've plotted it, you can kind of see it scene by scene or chapter by chapter or plot point by plot point, however you're doing it. When you're pantsing, you can't see it like that. I feel personally, you're too close to the novel to see the reader's experience of it. So what I'm hoping when I write my next novel, whenever that will be, I'm really going to make a conscious effort to plot and see where that gets me. So yeah, that's my big confession.
So placing was the most challenging part of writing the book. Maybe this is a silly question, but say you're given the note, you know, this is a beautiful chapter, but what does it do? How did you make it do something? How did you kind of fix your problem with pacing?
I think like one of the biggest lessons I learned was, you know, is that, you know, that famous phrase that everyone says, kill your darlings, is that I definitely learned to be less precious about words and what I'd written and not see it as a waste of time. So, you know, see it as me kind of telling myself the story and questioning whether the reader needs to know this information about this character, and you know, whether it actually moves the plot along, which is what kind of the phrase I had in mind when I was editing, like, does it service the plot, because that plot is king. So yeah, I think with a lot of it, with the editing process, I basically started by plotting the novel chapter by chapter as its original, and then looking at sort of in the next sort of column along what needed to change and then what that did to the plot. So I think potentially, like, I did plot, but the plotting came during the structural edits rather than the beginning, much to my editor's dismay. It's almost like I sort of plotted kind of almost too late, but it did really help me see sort of what were the key elements of the novel, and the story arcs as well. So yeah, I learned a lot. I basically learned how to write a novel during the editing process, which was a great experience.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I wondered if we could just rewind time a little bit and talk about how you got to this point. I often think that things change for writers when there's a moment in their life where they kind of think, I'm gonna take my writing seriously, or I'm going to start pursuing this professionally. Can you remember, was there a point when that kind of thought occurred to you, or did this kind of, how did this all happen really?
Yeah, of course. So yeah, I feel like I'm quite different to most writers. Like, whenever I listen to like sort of writing podcasts, which I do quite a lot, particularly yours, Chloe, but a lot of writers, you know, they've always wanted to sort of write, they've always wanted to potentially publish a novel and things like that, where I have to sort of that sort of thought really never occurred to me. Like, I was a reader first and foremost. I am still a reader first and foremost. I love books, but I never sort of once considered writing my own. I don't know why exactly that is, but it just didn't occur to me as something that like that one could do, you know. And so I never really, so I wrote in the normal way that people do at school when you're writing creative, you know, when you're doing creative writing. I made up stories in my head. I had quite a vivid memory as a child, but it was never something that I thought, oh, I could potentially, you know, do that and write a book. And so for me, it was more like I came to writing as more of like a need. Like, so it was more sort of therapy for me, first of all. Like, I kind of wrote my sort of grief and like the trauma that I experienced in my life as a way of healing, because I didn't really have any other tools available to me, and that really helped me. And then it was sort of when I was writing, I realized, one, how much I enjoyed it, and two, like how much I was able to sort of write in a way that sort of spoke to people about kind of real things. And I and that was kind of maybe the point where I thought, oh, you know, maybe I am a writer. Like, maybe this is something that I could do. But it wasn't until sort of COVID where I kind of set myself a task, because you know, we didn't have kids, and you know, and it was basically a way of surviving the sort of darkness of the world for me. And I thought, oh, if I could just bury myself in writing a novel and see what happens, whether I can even do it, let's see. So yeah, it was an alternative to baking banana bread, I think. And that's what it was for me. So yeah.
Amazing. I always find stories like that really interesting, because I just think there are some people who from the age of, I don't know, 18 are learning about editors and agents and studying the whole industry, and then some people just think, oh, I just fancy writing a book and
yeah,
give it a go. And it's, yeah, funny how, in that camp, how it works.
Yeah, I'm definitely in that camp. It was like, you know how some people say, oh, I'm gonna run a marathon one day, right? This is my equivalent, because I could never run a marathon. So I'm like, maybe I can run one in book form, which is what it was like for me. Yeah.
How did you go from that then, having a finished book during COVID, to then getting an agent and a book deal? How did all that happen?
Yeah, so I actually didn't have any industry knowledge. I'm a lawyer by profession. I don't really know anything about, or I didn't know anything about the industry. I didn't have any writer friends or anything. But so what I did was, when I sort of set myself this task of writing a novel, I thought, well, how do I know how to write a novel? I don't know how to write a novel. I don't even know where to start. So I actually applied for the Curtis Brown course in the January of 2020. And I said to myself, like, if I get onto this course, I think I had to write a sort of a chapter or something like that. And I said, if I can get onto this course, it was a 3-month novel writing course, then that is the accountability part. Like, you know, it's quite expensive. So I really have to write this novel or give it a good go. So they get, when I found out, I think it was March time, that I'd got onto sort of one of the groups. That was kind of it for me. And it was like through that course, really, that it gave me the elements of storytelling, which then I sort of applied to my novel. So I kind of wrote alongside that course, and that was yeah, that's how it all happened. Yeah, so as part of that course, actually, yeah, you could submit to an anthology. And that was kind of the exposure to agents and at Curtis Brown and kind of beyond. But I think before that, I'd had a bit of interest from Curtis Brown, a couple of Curtis Brown agents that had read some of what I'd written, or sort of seen the premise or whatever. And that gave me a bit of confidence, and it kind of led me into this, you know, rather than seeing it as a creative hobby, into this sort of whole, yeah, it sort of opened the door to the industry almost. And that's when I began to research agents and know and learn about this querying process and all that kind of thing. And so I'm not a very patient person. You know, a lot of people, it just depends on your personality. Like, in fact, a lot of my the students that were studying with me, like, they, you know, they're very much perfectionists and like to sort of be in a different position with their novel. But I was very much like, I don't know if this is any good until I submit it to an experienced professional that can tell me whether this is any good or not, or has potential, whatever. So yeah, then I thought, you know, let me just select five agents that I like the look of, or that I've, you know, who represent authors that that I love, and see where this gets me. And then I also submitted to one of the Curtis Brown agents who showed interest in my novel. So yeah, it kind of went from there. And yeah, I had quite a few full manuscript requests, and in the end, I had three offers. So yeah, it was kind of one of those things where I was just almost just like, you know, like seeing each stage and seeing how far I get, and like treading the water and kind of going along that kind of road and seeing where it would get me. So yeah, and then I signed with my agent not long after that, which was great.
And you've been probably one of, in a nice way, one of the most vocal kind of debuts that I know, in talking about the kind of difficulties of, well, we'll talk about kind of publishing in general in a minute, but also about how to juggle a full-time job and a very demanding job with writing, and that's kind of struggling to fit it in. So what's your advice for anyone that's feeling like they can't fit writing around their job? What do you do? What's your coping method?
Yeah, for sure. I think you're right. When you have a full-time job, or whether that's a job or caring responsibilities, you know, where your priority is elsewhere and you don't have this long period of time in a day to write, it can feel really daunting. And you can feel like there's no point you even starting this, because you'll never get to the end, because, you know, I that's a natural feeling to have, and I certainly felt like that. But you know what really helps me, and I think it's a piece of advice that is sort of given a lot, but like, I feel like writing on a regular basis, so in short sprints, so, you know, waking up maybe half an hour to sort of 40 minutes earlier than you would, or going to bed sort of 30 minutes 40 minutes later than you would, and just seeing what sort of comes out then. Because, you know, what I found is that when you have a break in your writing, it takes so much longer to sink back into the story, and you lose your momentum, because it's a whole different world that you've created, and it's really easy to sort of be thrown out of it into your daily reality. So yeah, I would say little and often is the way to create a novel, because it's so much easier to sort of continue something that you're sort of kind of doing on a daily basis, on a regular basis, and keeping that flow going. And then, I mean, if you can take annual leave, which is sometimes what I've done. Unfortunately, I've got to the point where I've taken too much annual leave that I haven't felt like I've had a break. So I wouldn't go as far as that, but if you can take like an odd Friday off and make it a long weekend of writing, that sometimes really helps. And I've done that a few times, sort of almost create your own writing retreat, but at home, and give yourself that time. But yeah, I do really sympathize with people that are juggling writing with a lot, because I know full-time writers struggle. So imagine what it's like writing with a full-time job or with full-time caring responsibilities. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Thank you, Mira, for that advice. Actually, I think that's really helpful and really great advice, because I think it's easy to say, you know, oh, well, you just fit it in, but I don't think many people have that luxury that they can just, you know, forget about work and write. I think most people, you know, we have to earn some money somewhere.
Exactly.
I've been so grateful to see authors like you and others help try and demystify the publishing process, because there's so many layers to it, and it is, can be incredibly confusing and complicated to navigate, particularly when you've never had any experience in it. And I know you've done some really brilliant posts on Instagram about it, which I will direct people to, and you've also written for the bookseller. But I wondered whether you could give us your best advice for coping with the ups and downs and the madness of being published.
Yeah, of course. By all means, yes. I think probably the sort of biggest thing for me, the biggest learning curve for me, is that, as I mentioned earlier, I was very new to the industry when I started writing, and it sort of all happened relatively quickly for me. And whilst that was, you know, I'm extremely grateful for that, what that did was give me a flawed perception of the industry, in the sense that sort of the picture created of the industry, whether that's by media, whether that's by authors, whether that's by publishers, is one of sort of success stories. And that's kind of what we hear, whether that's like the big success stories or just the little milestone success stories. But what I found was sort of very sort of not really talked about was the other side to things. And I do feel like that there is this pressure on authors to sort of convey things in a certain light, which may be kind of misleading, or sort of omit the bigger picture. So what I would say with advice is to keep your expectations and your goals realistic. So, you know, when going into sort of querying with agents, when going into sort of submitting to publishers and all of that stuff, because, you know, the bookseller articles, those big deals, those big foreign rights deals, you know, they really are so, so rare. And it doesn't feel that way because that's all you can really see and consume. But, you know, there are so many of us that are sort of have a very different experience. And so I think it's important to sort of value the all the other experiences that come with it. Keep your expectations sort of realistic in that sense. And I think that's maybe sort of what I need to do going forward as well. Because we don't have enough of celebrating the achievements. Like I don't think I ever, when I got to the end of my novel, I actually kind of commemorated that moment. I don't think I ever commemorated any of those moments because I was always thinking about, oh, what's next? You know, where are my foreign rights deals? Where are my TV deals? All of that kind of stuff. But that really isn't the reality for most authors from the get-go anyway. That stuff may come later. Mm. So yeah, I think that is probably the biggest learning curve for me. And the other part of it is, you know, only consume what you want to consume. Like if those stories get you down, it's okay not to, you know, it's okay to sort of go off social media for a bit, or it's okay to not read the bookseller. That's completely okay. You know, staying in your little bubble of writing your novel and enjoying that process is just sometimes all you really need to keep you going.
Yeah. On the note of keeping going, I'm going to quote yourself back to you. and you said, "I'd be lying if I said the last 2 years hasn't stifled my creativity and caused me to question my future in this industry," which is a big statement. And I know obviously there are ups and downs, and this is probably a moment where you felt a bit down about things, but I wondered what keeps you going, what makes you think, "No, I will not let this stifle my creativity. I'll carry on." What do you do on those days?
Oh, well, it depends on the day, Chloe. Sometimes I just love to wallow. No, in all seriousness, I think every writer feels like that, even like the real top sellers, because their road hasn't generally been a linear road. I'm sure there's been loads of knocks along the way. So I think part of being a writer, like what really helped me is when I signed with my agent, what I really loved about her and what I was drawn to and what made me sign with her was I remember her saying to me, you know, this book probably won't make you a bestseller. This book, you know, it's a very, very good book, but it's for various reasons, which I won't go into because it's quite boring. But, you know, it may not be the book to sort of make you a mainstream author. But that's okay. That's completely okay. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And, you know, if we're lucky, we can see ourselves doing this career. We hope to do this career for many years to come. So if you have everything you want on your first novel, where do you go from there?
Yeah.
Where do you go? And you know, sometimes you know it all falls away. So I that's kind of what's helped me, is like seeing it as very small, tiny steps in the right direction. And when you see them as small steps, the small steps that set you back aren't as bad. So there's kind of that perspective to things, but there's also, whilst you know, we were saying offline as well, Chloe, that we do need to make money from this. You know, you spend a lot of time writing, and whilst you do it because you love it, you do need to see some financial incentive to keep going. And that's completely fair. But then, you know, none of us should go into this career purely for the financial incentive. So I think sometimes it's good to sort of all strip it back. And now I'm almost kind of seeing it as like a really time consuming hobby opposed to like a career, because I'm very, very, very early on in this sort of career. And it doesn't really feel like a career most days because I'm not writing really most days. So yeah, I think I need to be grateful, and I kind of force myself as often as I can to be grateful that I have the process to be able to write. You know, I have the tools to be able to write. I have the joy of writing still. And if that falls away, then things will be difficult. But for now, I still enjoy writing. I still enjoy doing things like this. I still enjoy being an author. So there's enough for me to keep going there. So yeah, a very long-winded answer to your question.
So finally, Mira, can you give us a little tease about what you're working on at the moment? I know that the paperback of Her is imminent, but can you give us a little tease about the next book you're working on?
Yeah, of course. So I've just handed in my second round of structural edits for my second book, which is it's kind of very different because when I wrote Her, I didn't really write with the knowledge that I had, the commercial knowledge, the industry knowledge. I didn't even write to publish. I wrote it because I as a way of sort of coping with the world. So with this novel, I kind of acquired all that knowledge and I applied it, so it's much more commercial in terms of pitch. So essentially it's kind of a family drama, like with sort of set in an exotic location, and it's like a locked room thriller. So it's set in a place, a remote little hilltop village in Italy that becomes an island, and people are trapped there, and secrets sort of are exposed. So yeah, I think it's definitely sort of, I really like it because it's much, it taps into what people are reading and wanting to read. It's called The House Sitter and it's out next June, I believe. So yeah, not long to go, really.
Brilliant. Well, I mean, obviously with you're still doing publicity and things for Her, but I'm sure you'll be doing stuff for The House Sitter next year as well. I'm really excited to see it all unfold and read your next book as well. But thank you so much, Mira, for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much, Chloe. It's been lovely to be here.
That was Mira V. Shah talking about her psychological suspense novel, Her, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it'd be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.